So in our last recording, I guess this is confession again. I confessed that I was rereading Twilight for the first time since I was a teenager to prepare for Midnight Sun.
Yes, I think. Yes, I'm the wrong person to ask. Right. I secretly was overjoyed at you're not enjoying it as much as you anticipated.
I am just shocked. I'm really shocked by it. And actually, there's more I wanted to say about it because I just pinched my nipple in front of you. I don't know why I did that. I'm so sorry.
I didn't even notice it, but then you brought it to my attention. That was really lovely.
Ooh, I am as pink as my shirt. So the other night I was reading it again and I just keep like laughing in bed because I just can't believe some of this stuff. And there's a part where Bella finally meets Edward's fam. It's like 20 pages to the end of the book. Nothing happens in this book. He like sits down at the piano and plays a song he wrote for her. And she...
You can't even tell me about it with a straight face.
She starts to cry. Mm-hmm. And I just need to read this part because I like literally... Josh was asleep next to me and I just like couldn't believe this. It says, "Thank you," I murmured. I realized there were tears in my eyes. I dabbed at them, embarrassed. He touched the corner of my eye, trapping one I missed. He lifted his finger, examining the drop of moisture broodingly. Then, so quickly I couldn't be positive that he really did, he put his finger to his mouth to taste it.
Blech.
And like, at what point in any of that description is that romantic?
Even in a pre-COVID world, get your fingers out of my eyeballs.
Seriously, that's and not then don't romantic. Eat it. And like, and the idea of him doing it so quickly, like, just like, you know what I mean? Like, what, like, what about witnessing him like move like a fly is particularly sexy?
I feel like if someone came for my eyeball, I would not be able to stop my reflex of just like smacking their hand away from my eyeball.
It's a wild, wild ride. I will say though, I haven't read anything else she's done though. Like I have no idea if she's particularly good outside of this either.
No, I don't either. My reaction to Twilight is so like large and firm that I just can't go out, you know, I'm good.
But I cannot wait then for us to read Midnight Sun at the exact same time you're doing it. I'm sorry.
I stand by my feeling that you're going to have to buy my copy because I don't even want to spend money on it.
Absolutely. I will. That will be a gift for me to buy that copy for you.
What a special gift.
Welcome to Book It,
a bi-weekly podcast where we talk frankly about books. Book It is hosted by the Blue Manatee Literacy Project,
a nonprofit that operates an independent bookstore in Cincinnati, Ohio.
When you shop with Blue Manatee, you are giving back to the community. For every book purchased, BMLP donates a book to a child in need.
Book It is hosted by me, Michael Woodson.
And me, Jill Burkett Ragacy.
Oh, anyway, welcome back to Book It, where I... Apparently, now all I talk about is Twilight, but I have to stand something, apparently.
Well, we're done standing Harry Potter for a little bit.
We're taking a break from that. I can't talk about it. Yep. All I can say is, like, we don't agree, and we believe trans women and trans rights, and that's all I'm going to say.
Yep.
What are we talking about today, Jill?
Today, we are talking about pet peeves.
Love them. Hate them.
Yeah. Whole episode full of things we hate... We hate to hate. I don't know. We hate to love. I don't know. These are just things we don't enjoy about books and publishing in general.
Yes. And I think that something like when we call it pet peeves or something, it has a really negative connotation naturally because it's things we don't like. But I actually think recognizing the things you don't like in things that you enjoy makes you better at that thing. Like...
Yeah.
If I know what I don't like in books, I think that makes me a better reader. If I know what I don't like in movies or stage or music, I think that just makes me a better listener and viewer.
Yeah.
So, like, if you have pet peeves, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think it's a good thing. I think that just means you know how to critique something and you know what you like. And that means you probably like that thing a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of times if I know a book is going to touch or come close to a pet peeve, it... does manage my expectation. I mean, we talked about expectations so much in the last episode, but if I know a book is going to like come up on something that I don't really enjoy, but I know it ahead of time, I can be like, okay, so this is not a thing I love. I'm going to read this book and I know that is there, and I can almost kind of set it aside a little bit.
Yeah.
See the book maybe instead of just kind of focusing on the pet peeve, I can almost set the pet peeve aside and say, hey, this is a pet peeve. What about the rest of it?
Totally. And I think that it helps us separate personal taste with, like, is it successful at the thing it's trying to do?
Mm-hmm.
Those two things can exist at the same time. Like, it cannot be for me, but it can still have achieved what it wanted to achieve.
Absolutely.
That being said, everything we're talking about today, I think maybe those two things can intersect. Like, some of my pet peeves also suggest when certain things don't succeed what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
Let's just get right into it.
I agree. Did anything spring to mind when I said we were going to talk about pet peeves?
I think in a broader sense, first is my pet peeve of mine is relates to book people. And in the world that we live in now, something known as Bookstagram. I love Bookstagram. Mm-hmm. And I participate in Bookstagram in a light way. I have a personal Instagram and it isn't a Bookstagram, and I don't ever want to make it one, because one, books are so important to me, and I probably more over everything else, I'm a reader, but there are many facets of Michael. So I wouldn't want my entire identity to be books. You know, I have a husband, I'm part of the gay community, I have a dog, I love animals, like all of these things are who I am. On top of the fact that there's this quality of Bookstagram that is sort of like more is more.
Yeah.
And I just don't think that reading 7 books a week necessarily makes you a better reader than people who read 1 book a month. And I think that it's more about how are you connecting with the text? How are you critiquing it? Why did you like it? I'm just as interested in a person's perspective on a single book than I am about the amount of books they're reading in a month. And I think there's this odd competition among Bookstagrammers to read like 150 books a year and then let everyone know that they did that. And I'm just not into that. Like, I really love spending a lot of time on a book, especially that I'm really liking. I'm not in a hurry to finish a book that I love.
I feel like I have a love-hate relationship with Bookstagram in the same way that I have a love-hate relationship with all social media.
Right.
It takes something that is fun, that I like reading, and then makes it have to look a certain way.
Exactly.
And I'm like, no. And I don't know. I'm torn between... you know, at the beginning last week, I was like, hey, on my own Instagram, if you're interested in reading more diversely, here's some accounts that you might want to try. These are ones that I follow. And 2 of the accounts in my little description, I mentioned how beautiful the photographs were. And I was like, but that's not what I like about them. And so then I was like, looking back at myself, like, what do I actually like about these? It's not the... Because, I mean, who cares if a book picture looks pretty. That's fantastic.
Sure, yes.
But the reason I'm following them is to know about the books.
Right.
And so Bookstagram just feels like this dichotomy to me where we're presented in one way, but what I'm really interested in is not what it looks like at all.
Exactly. And I think it buys into a little bit kind of what we talked about in the last episode, which was expectations versus reality. It really blurs that line of reality. I mean, social media does that. It blurs the lines of reality all of the time. So then my expectations for something is this perfectly curated version of what I might not be getting. And then I'm playing into that. I don't know. It's just like, I'm just like way more interested in a person's thoughtful perspective on possibly one book than I am on whether or not they met their quota for the month.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I agree. I would say my leading book pet peeve is when books you don't like or you just thought they were okay become wildly popular.
Yep.
Yeah. And then, you know, because we're booksellers, you have to live with that, like, right. every day. And so I have to say, the most recent example of this for me is Where the Crawdads Sing. I had not read this book before it became the Reese Book Club pick. And I normally like her picks, so I went into it with the expectation that I would like it.
Sure.
And I did not like it. Really, like, I got through the first third and did not like it. I kept reading it. I still didn't like it. I thought it was fine. It continuing to be on the bestseller list now is just wholly confusing to me. Setting aside all of the repetition in the narrative, which drove me crazy, the really trope, stereotypical romance elements that had like no nuance to them whatsoever drove me crazy. But the worst part is the Southern dialect in that book is terrible.
Wow.
And I was so annoyed that only the Black people in the book spoke in this, what was often kind of an extreme Southern dialect. And Kaya, who for most of her life only talked to Jumpin' and Mabel and lived in the rural South in like a shack with no electricity and only learned to read in adulthood, somehow magically always spoke standard American vernacular English. And this, I feel like, was not touched upon in the discussion or the reviews of this book.
Of course it wasn't. Who do you think reviewed these books?
It just drove me crazy.
I've actually heard that a lot about Where the Crawdads Sing.
Oh, good.
Well, okay. I say that, again, as a bookseller, I my version of heard that a lot is probably not someone else's. Like,
yeah.
Issa, who we love, who used to work at the bookstore and now is a rock star in Michigan, brought that to my attention because I was considering reading Where the Crawdads Sing because, to your point, it was massive. I mean, before it came out, it was already massive. And as a bookseller, as book people, I wanted to read it. And she kind of convinced me to maybe not give it the attention. But that's really all I heard about it. This is the most I've ever heard in terms of like the details of why it was so frustrating. And when something feels inauthentic, I think, especially, that's a real pet peeve because it feels like, that's kind of what it sounds like you're saying, is that so much of it was inauthentic and a little bit stereotypical at the same time.
Yeah. And stereotypical in multiple ways, I think, is what bothered me about it. But that book was on the indie bestseller list as recently as the list that was published last week.
Really?
Yeah.
And this podcast will come out in July 2020.
Right. I mean, this book has been out now for what?
6 months?
2 years? A what? Year? Has this book been out for a year? No, okay. So this book came out in August of 2018, and it was the Reese Witherspoon Book Club pick in September of that year.
So this was right before Blue Manatee Literacy Project
opened.
Yes. And so in our store, it's only ever been a bestseller. I mean, like, when we did a roundup this past January of our children's bestsellers, our young adult, our chapter book, Where the Crawdads Sings was our adult bestseller, and none of us was surprised.
No, I would say this book, and we continued to sell Educated as if it came out like last week, which is, I mean, I love that book. Was so compelling and just so mind boggling to me that I get that one. I get more.
Sure.
But yeah, this book continues to be wildly popular. We continue to stock it and sell it regularly. It was on last week's independent indie bookstore's bestseller list.
Wow. That's a really great example of also the combination of when something is like wildly popular, also critically acclaimed, and when the culture kind of all gravitates towards a book that you necessarily don't think is the best option.
Right. Oh, that's a really good segue into my next pet peeve. Can I go again?
Yeah.
Okay. When the culture at large goes to the same book over and over again that you think maybe isn't the best or only option. And my two examples are The Kissing Hand. I have three examples. The Kissing Hand for Back to School, the little raccoon, and his mom kisses his hand and then closes it and says, "Now you'll take me and my love with you everywhere you go." The Dr. Seuss, The Places You'll Go at Graduation Time. And anything by Nancy Tillman for a baby shower.
Why do you think this is?
I don't know. There are other really good books available on all those topics.
Is it just because we are a people that is afraid of change? So we just like endlessly go to tradition?
I have no idea. The Kissing Hand is now 20 years old. And I get it when something's a classic.
Right.
And I know like teachers are all really aware of this, and there's tons of like resources online available for its use, which I know also contributes to it being like a go-to. And it's a fine book. I don't love it. It feels super saccharine to me. It's just not like my style. But I get why, in that case, I get why people love it. Like, it's just not my first choice. But I would take like School's First Day of School or The King of Kindergarten or We Don't Eat Our Classmates over The Kissing Hand, or at least in addition to The Kissing Hand.
Right, right. It doesn't have to be there. You know, what's the phrase? Lots of options. Like, it doesn't have to just be like the one. Something is the spice of life.
Oh, it's variety is the spice of life.
Yes, variety is the spice of life. Can't that just be true? Like, why are we just getting these over and over again? And to your point, I think it's also like, we talked about this a little bit in the last episode, the idea of something being saccharine. I actually think it's a too easy a sell, and it's a little bit manipulative, which is why The Fault in Our Stars didn't really stick with me in terms of long term, because it just felt like an unearned emotion. To your point, it's like, yeah, I do get why this is selling, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's the only, the best or the only available option.
Yes. It has gotten to the point, like at graduation time when people come in, I'm not going to lie, one thing I enjoyed about being closed for COVID was that I did not have to find the places you'll go for anyone. But it's gotten to the point where at graduation time, when people come in and ask for that, I'm like, hey, can I show you this Emily Winfield Martin's book called The Wonderful Things You Will Be? Like, I will grab that for you. But while I'm getting that for you, will you also look at this?
Right, right.
Like, pushing my pet peeves on other people.
Well, and that's why, like, we offer a curated experience. Yeah. And so it's like, I think that's part of it. It's like, sure, like, I will offer this to you because that's what you want, because it's the time, it's the season for it. 'Tis the season. But like, you're here. That's something I think many book sellers, people who work in the book industry, are probably that's going to resonate with them for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just, I always just take it as like a personal win if they will pick something else.
Right.
Like, I don't know why I care. But I don't know. There's just something about it. I'm like, yeah, I know that you saw this book on Instagram or on Pinterest.
Right.
And you've got like a whole plan. But what if, what if it was just slightly different?
I never thought about that. Like, the book, it's that it's the places you'll go isn't, it's actually kind of irrelevant. It's like what we've created around it.
Yeah.
And like, because I'm thinking about that now, when my sister graduated high school, the theme was, oh, the places you'll go. Mm-hmm. And, you know, our gym had all these Dr. Seuss characters around it. And it was just like, at the time I was 15, like, that seemed really unique.
Yeah.
And now I'm like, sorry. Everyone does that every year, always, for the rest of our lives. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I don't know what it is, but it seems like there's, and I know there's other things where just like, as a culture, we just kind of all go to like, there's just one book for like whatever it is.
Yeah. Why is that?
I don't know.
I honestly just think it's tradition. I think it's just that like, it's too much work to look for something new.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, like at Christmas time, we always like sell like The Night Before Christmas and the Nutcracker books. Like every year, here they are. It's the Maurice and Nutcracker book. Like it's right. The same one. And again, like this year, we brought in that cute Nutcracker and Harlem book. And I was like, look, we have other versions of this.
Right.
In that case, it's like, it's still the Nutcracker.
Yeah, no matter what, it's the Nutcracker.
Right.
It's interesting that you bring up like Christmas and Christmas books, because I think it has something, I do think it has something to do with seasons, because we don't love new Christmas songs even. It's like,
yeah.
Pop stars can like release Christmas albums, but we don't remember them. We just remember the carols that we all grew up with. But it's like, they can get so grating and just like annoying to hear after 2 full months of them, that it's like, why don't we allow for new media around graduation, around mm-hmm. holidays, around all of these things? This is another like wider, like reader pet peeve, and not necessarily a book specific one. But I don't love when readers can't critique something that is a piece of a larger thing that they love. So I'm talking book series, authors themselves, these types of things. Those two things can exist at the same time. You can love something and wish that this part of it was better and ask for better.
The dialogue in Twilight.
Exactly. but it's hard because we made these pet peeves before things were released. I'm thinking J.K. Rowling here, and I don't want to talk about her, but there are aspects of certain franchises that I really don't think are very good. And whenever I bring those up with people, they think that I hate that franchise. I'm just like, no, I love that franchise, but that doesn't mean I have to just blanket love all of it. That doesn't make me a very good reader.
I felt that way last week when we talked about Suzanne Collins and The Hunger Games.
Totally. Yes.
I like those books. That said, there are some ways I wish they were different.
I think because you like them, that lands a lot harder with me, because you like them. You know what I mean? Like, if someone didn't like them, and then if someone hated this thing about it and also didn't like them anyway, I don't know what I'm learning there. But if someone's telling me like, I really like those books, this wasn't great about it, I'm going to take that to heart, because it's like, oh, okay, like, that's not easy for people to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that frustrates me.
Yeah, and I think, you know, just in general, we tend to prefer things are black and white. I mean, it's so much harder to have a conversation with nuance of any kind.
Yeah.
And I feel like we're all kind of pre-programmed to look for this, like, gotcha moment in something. And so I think it's hard to say, I like something. I acknowledge that there are parts that are problematic. I like something and I acknowledge that the creator of them is problematic. Yes. I like something but I don't love it and I still see its flaws is a message that's just doesn't land right now, I feel like. I think it's the conversations are harder. They're not designed to be on social media.
Right.
They're meant to be discussed.
Yes, absolutely. And like, there's no nuance there. But I don't think we can make these things like these untouchable deities or these perfect specimens, because we are humans. And then once they do something that is wrong, it ends up being like really, really, really heartbreaking. And then I think the important thing is to recognize that. I don't think you can ignore it. I don't think you can be like, it, kind of like what we're going through right now, like silence is pretty loud. So I think like an inability to critique something that you love sends a statement that you didn't mean to send.
Yeah, absolutely.
You and I talked a little bit before we recorded. And I'm really curious about this one pet peeve you told me about, because I have some feelings about it as well, which is when a good, you know, like couple of chapters are followed by a bunch of shitty ones.
Yeah, a book with a promising start that goes downhill.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a pet peeve of mine. And if it has been especially coupled with like really high expectations, it's like totally. So crushing to me. And the example that I brought today was Turtles All the Way Down by John Green. Mm-hmm. And I want to start by saying I love John Green.
Again, and you love John Green and you can critique this.
I have considered myself part of the Nerdfighter community since like 2007 when it was Vlogbrothers like 2.0. I loved that this book showed mental illness and an empathetic mm-hmm. and really real way, but also this book was a mess.
It was a mess.
The mystery and the love story and the mental health aspects all felt like they were compartmentalized into like thirds of the book.
Sure.
You start off, and at the beginning of the story, especially, it feels like a straightforward mystery. There's a missing eccentric billionaire. There's a murky river. There's a mansion full of potential secrets. And you're like, okay, great. And then the trail kind of dead ends on that. And you begin to expect a plot twist, like something's coming that I didn't expect. But it's not so much that the plot twist, this like the focus of the narration shifts. And all of a sudden, it's not a mystery book. It's a love story. And we take that to a certain point and then we shift focus again. And now it's about mental illness. And then we take that to its semi-conclusion. And then we realize that the mystery we started with hasn't been solved yet. So we spend the last 50 pages doing that. And... It doesn't weave together in the way the previous books did. And some of the recurring mental illness metaphors, I just felt like they were hammered.
Sure.
It was like Thor's hammer.
I even forgot that there was remotely a mystery element until we started talking about it just now.
That's hilarious. My husband and I discussed it, and I said that the book was like going to a Coldplay concert. Like, you're supposed to cry. like, it's supposed to, like the ebb and flow of it is a Coldplay concert. And here's what it boils down to for me. John Green is so talented.
So good.
If any other writer had attempted this, it would be a total hot mess train wreck. And because it's John Green, and he is so skilled... It's just sort of fine. I didn't love it, but it was fine.
And to your point, like, I think also because it was his most recent book after, like, mm-hmm. lots of... We knew his talent, so had this been his first book, I think we would have... Our perspective would have been, this isn't great, but this author has a lot of potential. Like, I can't wait to see what he's going to write next. Versus... This is not nearly as good as
Paper Towns,
so many of his other books, because we know what he's able to do. Which, not to talk about Gilmore Girls, but it's exactly how I feel about season 7 of Gilmore Girls. I think that it's not very good.
No.
But it's another show's really good first season. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's season 7 followed 6 amazing seasons. Had season 7 been season 1, I would have been like, that was an okay first season, but it was good enough that I want to see where this goes. So I do think it's a little bit like, I'm not unbiased enough because I love Gilmore Girls too much, but I do think there's something there with that. Like, I think that John Green isn't afforded the same room to like make mistakes mm-hmm. anymore. Like most authors who have like several books under their belt that like killed it and killed it and killed it. So then we're like, I think way more hard on the missteps than we would be with debut authors.
I just felt like the beginning of that book, I was so in it and so ready to love it. And then I kept going, wait, what's happening now? Wait, right, what? Right. But I was
honestly,
in it in
I
the
forgot.
Beginning. It felt more like Paper Towns to me in the beginning. And so I was excited. And then I was like, wait, oh, now we're going to talk about this. Oh, okay. Oh, now we're over here. Are we getting back to, like, what I thought was the premise of this book?
Which is, like, a really... That's, like, a pet peeve within a pet peeve is, like, when a premise starts really well and then it's not great. But also when there's, like, completely disregarded plot lines.
Yeah.
It feels like there was no planning involved.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And I just that one was hard for me because I did not love, we talked about this already. Oh God, what's the one with the cancer kids in the movie?
The Fault in Our Stars.
I did not love The Fault in Our Stars. I just felt like it was okay. Right. Definitely like it better than Turtles All the Way Down. But mm-hmm. I felt like it was fine. It was good. It wasn't, it didn't speak to me in the way the other ones had. And so I kind of went into it with the expectation that it was going to be more like the other. I don't know.
I know, I hear you. And I also think that like, I'm going to contradict myself here. It's less of a bummer when an author you already know you love writes a book that isn't as good as that author's other work than it is Ooh. When you read a book, which is a writer's first book, and it's just not very good, but it had such good promise, promise. In talking about this, I remember a book that came out, I think this last January, it was called Topics of Conversation. It was being like lauded as a real like a literary work from a debut author. And I went to the bookstore and read the first couple of pages, and it was, in terms of its writing style, right up my alley. I was really excited to read it. And then I was reading these really so-so reviews for it, like really just okay reviews. And I didn't get it because I was like, but this is really speaking to me so far. Like I'm really liking the way she's writing, and I like the setup. And the more that I got into it, the more I understood why everyone was hating it.
Yeah. I did not recall this book when we first started talking about it. So I Googled it while we were talking, and now that I see the cover, I remember it. But because I think we talked about it at the time.
Yeah, and I started reading it, and I liked the first chapter so much. And then, like, almost immediately, I was like, oh, this is pretty terrible. Like, it's not just not as good as the first chapter. It was, like, frustratingly bad. Mm. And I was talking to a friend of mine who is a reader and works for a writing magazine, actually. And we were talking about it because I saw on Goodreads that she had read it, too, and she gave it a pretty scathing review. And I was like, I just finished Topics of Conversation, and I hated it. And I don't say that very often about books. Well, I should probably let other people tell me that, but I don't think I say that very much about books.
Yeah.
And she was like, she told me that she is part of one of those monthly book club subscriptions where they send a book to you and you read it.
Yeah.
And that was one of the book club picks. And it was so poorly received from that book club that whatever subscription base was that, refunded everybody that book.
Oh, wow.
Which was, like, I think really significant because That's it wasn't wild. Just, like... wild,
yeah.
I was, like, offended by it. It was just... In the same way that, like, we praised the show Girls for being this, like, crazy feminist... Not crazy, good. Like,
yeah.
A moment in television that was, like, very feminist... And then quickly realized, oh, it's just white feminism. It's really, really selfish 20-year-olds. That's how this book read. It was like, this had so much potential to do the right thing. And then I had, not in the way that is like fun to read, I just didn't care about the main character at all. And she just was so selfish. And I think that was supposed to be, that she was aware of her selfishness was supposed to be enough, but it just wasn't.
Mm.
So that was a real peppy. Talking about books that have a lot of promise and then just go downhill. That's the most significant, most recent disappointment I've had reading a book.
I did not read that one, but I think it's because we talked about it.
Yeah, don't read it. Sorry. Whatever. Like, sorry if you're listening to this. I can't remember. Miranda Popke, I think is her name.
Yeah.
And then also, this kind of falls under that too, but I have a really hard time. I'm getting more and more squeamish the older I get.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a book that I started to read that was just a lot about physical abuse, and physical abuse for a really young person. Like, I think she's 13 or 14. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't finish it. It was had a lot of promise and was really critically acclaimed, but I just couldn't stomach it. And it was called My Absolute Darling. And I stopped reading it. And then like a week later, I saw a friend of mine on Instagram posting that she read it and was asking people like, has anybody else been able to finish this? Like, I'm actually having a hard time getting through it. And I've read some pretty dark stuff. And I commented to her, like, I couldn't finish it either. It was just like too visceral in its abuse to a young person that I just couldn't finish it.
Yeah. I found after I had kids, my tolerance level for any plot where like a child is abused, I just see it or experience it differently now. And so I kind of really, I have to be in a different mindset to read it at all.
Yeah.
And a lot of times I just have to, I read a little bit and I set it aside, and I read a little bit and I set it aside, and they definitely take me longer to get through.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do somewhat shy away from them now.
Yeah. I don't know if I'll ever return to that one, and part of me wants to, but now especially, I think I'm good.
Yeah, absolutely.
The year we've had, I think I'm good. Something else too, and I don't necessarily have like a specific example here, but I think when a pet peeve of mine in fiction specifically, and this, I think this gravitates towards genre writing, but when like a plot twist is unearned or a shock is unearned, if a shock is just a shock, or especially when like a character dies and they make a big point that this character is dead, and then two books later the reveal is that they're alive, that feels really like a waste of my time and a frustration, because it feels really manipulative, which I guess is the pet peeve there, is just being hyper aware of like the manipulation happening.
Yes, and the difference between a twist and a manipulation.
That's a really good way to put it, because I love a twist, because I am the best person for a twist, because I never see anything coming. I am never guessing what's next. So like, just throw a twist at me and I'm going to be like shocked. But then if you take that twist away, I'm really frustrated, because I usually have like a pretty big reaction to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And unfortunately, I don't have an example, because it's just like a general, don't do this to me anymore.
Yeah, I will say one plot element involving death that you and I have discussed. I recently read At the Bone. We discussed it from the aspect of 9/11, and it did not necessarily bother me. I did not see it coming, and it didn't necessarily bother me that 9/11 was a plot point in the book. But overall, the death of just felt, it was an easy way to bring the mother and the daughter together instead of like doing the work to plot it out, is what it felt like to me. It wasn't that it was 9/11. That didn't bother me. It just felt like the easy route towards driving to the end of the book. And I just didn't think it was necessary. I felt like they could have come together if he lived. And it felt like, I don't know. It just didn't, it didn't feel organic, but I guess 9/11 didn't feel organic. I don't, maybe I'm changing my mind on this as we talk about it.
No, I think you're feeling badly, because you think I'm like really upset.
Well, I told you earlier, I don't like to criticize something that you have expressed is meaningful to you, because that feels really unkind.
No, but I mean, like, I don't take that personally. And like I said, I like when people are able to critique something that they ultimately didn't hate. Like, I think there's value in saying this part I disagree with, but you know, so I don't really feel I love this kind of conversation, especially because I don't agree with you. Like, I think that, well, I guess I do totally see your point, but I just didn't feel that way. And I think because of the way, well, this isn't really a spoiler book. I wonder if, whatever, it's like, dead. So
spoiler alert.
Spoiler. Because in reading it, I realized that I had never read a narrative where in 9/11 the person who dies wasn't a hero. It was just a person who was a common person who, like, whose personal story has been buried by the white savior. And he was just a person going to work. And the reality of that really broke my heart, because it's true. Like, he was just, in the way that, like, most people died in 9/11, like, hindsight's 2020, because, like, I can't imagine my life now without 9/11 having happened, because it was so traumatic. But the reality was, people who weren't heroes died in that. Long story short, it didn't bother me because it felt like a story that hadn't been written yet about a moment that was so important. Yeah, no,
from that aspect, I really think you're right, because immediately following it, you know, I felt like we had the paraphernalia for, like, NYPD and the fire department. Everyone was wearing, like, sweatshirts and ball caps. And to be clear, those first responders were impacted very deeply. But the vast majority of people who died were just going to work, just like regular people. And it is a chance to share that aspect of the story that hasn't been told. And so from that perspective, I completely agree with you from that perspective.
But I do think it does. It's a tricky tightrope act, because I really didn't see it coming, because it wasn't so something that Jacqueline Woodson does really well is she makes her stories feel timeless. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't necessarily at any point too aware that I was in the year 2001.
No, I had lost track of where we were.
So that when he died, I was like, oh, this is 9/11. Like, this is 2001. And she's not overt about it. She doesn't say, like, and he was in the World Trade Center and he died. Mm-hmm. You just put it together because she trusts the reader to be reading closely. But I've looked at a lot of the Goodreads reviews, and people are really tripped up around that. Like, people are like, I'm confused. Is dead? Like, did he die in 9/11? And people are saying, like, yeah, yes, yes. So I think that, like, it is tricky, and it's a difficult thing to do. And especially if you, as a writer, you want to write about it, how do you do it where it doesn't feel like you're exploiting it? It's hard not to exploit 9/11. I mean, everything feels like an exploitation of that, because it was such a tragedy. But I think she pulled that off.
You've mentioned something that I didn't have in our list, but now we've mentioned it 4 or 5 times in this conversation, so I feel like we should talk about it a little bit as a pet peeve.
Which is?
Goodreads.
Oh.
Oh, not a pet peeve for you?
No, I just didn't think about it.
I have kind of a love-hate relationship with Goodreads.
Sure.
I know from Twitter, mostly, that a lot of people use it to tank and negatively review books by women and LGBTQIA authors.
Is that true?
Yeah. Yeah. People will go in on books that have not been published yet and leave bad reviews. Like, it's not coming out for 8 months. You haven't identified yourself in any way that you are related to a bookstore or a person who's received an advanced copy. And you just dunk on the book and how terrible it is. And the authors are like, there's literally no way you could have read this. And there's no mechanism in Goodreads to respond or ask for things to be deleted. And a couple of authors that I follow were having a conversation, because one of them has a book coming out in which the main character is gay. And she said, you know, like, I clicked on this person and I went back and looked at their reviews, and this is literally how they're using this tool, is exclusively to harass and try to tank authors with books whose topics they don't agree with.
I never ever thought about that. I feel like an idiot, because, like, that's, of course people are doing that, because there isn't enough, like, I don't want to say policing, because it's not what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
But, like, there's no
rhyme or reason to, like, there's not an oversight.
At all. Which is true with, like, I never thought about that in the book world. Because, like, IMDb, people, any one of us, other media has that problem. Like, I take IMDb ratings with a grain of salt, because I just assume it's a lot of, like, pissed off moviegoers. Yeah, it's like an audience react, basically. But, like, the problem is that people are reacting based off of their personal bias and not from the experience they had with the book, because the book isn't even out yet. That's really frustrating.
Yeah.
And that's annoying because it's like, that should just be a community. That should be a lovely community.
It's not. I feel like it's a misnomer to say that Goodreads is a pet peeve of mine. It's the misuse of the community of that Goodreads is.
Well, to your point, though, like we said before, like, it's a love-hate relationship. It's social media. I mean, it's a website, but, like, I have a love-hate relationship with social media, too, because of the way people have abused its purpose.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where I'm somewhat reticent to weigh in on it too heavily. I have a Goodreads account, and I don't ever review books there. So I guess I'm part of the problem. But I do review on Edelweiss, which is the website that the bookstore, independent bookstores use to place orders for things. And but one of the analytics that Edelweiss gives you when you are weighing whether or not to purchase a book for the store is how much buzz a book is getting on Goodreads. Huh. And I know from following so many authors on Twitter that aspect of it is frustrating to them because there's so much going on behind the scenes there that is wholly out of their control but might be deeply unfair.
Let's talk about publishers for a second, because I think that publishers obviously have a different job to do than the writers do, but mm-hmm. I think I worry a lot about an author's happiness once a book has come out, because publishers just need to sell the books. And they're going to do whatever they can to sell them. And a pet peeve of mine is when they kind of ignore the artistic aspect, the integrity of it, just to sell a book. And I'm thinking, like, the Blue Mantle Literacy Project isn't a children's bookstore, but we have a big children's audience. Mm-hmm. And it's so frustrating when I see a beautiful illustrated cover that is, like, stickered with all of these different things. And I think, of course, it's important to know when a book has won an award, and an important one at that, but isn't there another way to let us know without ruining the cover?
I love the award stickers, and I'm trying to think of the book that has, like, three or four stickers on the front of it. Like, you can't even hardly see the cover anymore. The ones that drive me crazy are when it's been picked by like Jenna Hager Bush or Reese Witherspoon or Oprah, and it's got a lovely cover, and then they put a sticker on it. Or at the store when we get signed editions in, and it's got the signed, for whatever reason, every publisher, when they want to tell you it's a signed edition, they can't put, like, a quarter size sticker on it, which would maybe blend into the cover. They put, like, a baseball size sticker on the front. Signed copy.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Like, that especially is really frustrating. But, like, why aren't they asking the cover designers for their input? Like, instead of, I want to know that this is a Newbery winner. So then, like, ask the person who did the cover to do that. Because, like, I'm thinking about The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas has a book cover that I am obsessed with. And it's won a lot of awards, and it totally has earned those awards. But I think that the impact of the cover is a little bit lost because all of these award stickers are on it. And I think that there was a way to be able to do that without ruining the integrity of the cover.
I just grabbed mine while you were talking.
See, and mine had two others. It had that and then two other stickers on it.
Yes, my copy only has the National Book Award long list sticker, but the sticker, again, is so humongous that it's totally, the front cover is beautiful, and so much of the composition of it is the use of white space.
Exactly.
It's got a giant sticker on it. Yeah.
Which is, like, that, again, was a decision, the cover was a decision based off of the context of the book, and I feel like, I want to know how authors feel about it. I doubt they're allowed to say, but I want to know. I'm curious about, like, does that bother them, or are they just, like, stoked to have won an award? Because also, this is coming from somebody who has never published anything, who was dying to. So if I won, like, three awards, I'd be like, ruin my cover. I don't care.
Yeah, the sticker probably sells copies too. I don't know. Yeah. The look of the sticker, though, that can be a pet peeve, I think.
Yeah. And, like, just ask the cover designer. They will have an idea. They're designers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I know I said that this episode was like not necessarily negative, but I'm feeling really angry.
Now that we've dunked on all of your favorite books for an hour.
Let's leave optimistic. I need something positive here. Because I do still feel like pet peeves aren't a bad thing. But like after sitting and talking for an hour about bad things, like I'm in a bad way.
Well, here's what I would say. And it circles back to your point about being able to criticize something you love. The Hate U Give, the book we just said, the cover has been ruined by a sticker. I love this book. I have put it on our Instagram stories. Every time I reread it, I bring it back up for my Monday book recommendations because yep. It's good every single time.
I love The Hate U Give.
I love that book. And I mean, some of the other things we talked about today, John Green, I still love John Green. I'm going to buy every John Green book there is. Hank Green's new book comes out next month. I'm buying that too. Because they're good. They're good stories. And part of why we're annoyed by aspects of this is because we love these books in general. And we love reading.
My love of reading is not dependent on whether or not I ended up loving the book.
Yeah.
I love to read anything. And I wouldn't know what these pet peeves are if I didn't love to read.
Exactly.
And I do need to say, like, I wish I hadn't said anything about The Hate U Give, because I do love that book. I love the cover, too. That's why I'm annoyed that there are so many stickers on it.
No, this book is all about the white space focusing you in on Star Carter, and the stickers are taking away from that. And it's got a limited use of colors, and it's all about the white space and then the really bold graphic spine. Mm. And the sticker is definitely ruining the cover. Luckily, it's not impacting the inside. Bye, The Hate U Give.
So, don't hate me. Bye. Yeah. But as always, this is a lovely chat. I am curious about other readers. What are your pet peeves? Do you have any? Or are you a pretty, like, do you care? Or do you just read for joy?
Yeah. Yeah. Let us know.
Let us know. Jill.
Yes.
Thanks for chatting with me.
Absolutely. This was really fun. You know, just an hour of airing our grievances.
Yeah, it's cheese and wine hour. Oh, we didn't have cheese or wine. Next time, let's have cheese and wine.
Next time.
Yeah. Bye.
See ya.
Thank you for listening to Book It, a bi-weekly podcast. If you're interested in learning more or donating to the Blue Manatee Literacy Project, you can find us online at bluemanatee.org. If you're in Cincinnati, come by and see us. We're located at 3094 Madison Road in Oakley.